Group meeting, Friday, 11th May, 1984. The importance of listening and seeing ourselves remaining as free as possible from our conditioning enables us to live religiously, in the real sense of the word. Religious living has nothing to do with beliefs, dogmas, convictions, ideas, and so forth. Religious living is actually completely natural living. Natural living meaning living as the perfect human organism, the perfectly healthy human organism, healthy, whole, psychically, and holy, therefore. If the psychophysical organism is truly healthy, body and psyche, then it is a holy organism. It is the microcosmic representation of transcendence itself, of the total reality. That is why it is so important to try to use all our senses throughout the day in such a manner that we experience all the impressions that come to us, all the stimuli that come to us, as if they were coming for the first time. Now, if we can appreciate the significance of this, we will see at once it is almost a superhuman task. Because from the start, this reptilian and mammalian brain, which is sensitive to reptilian and mammalian behavior, is not going to favor us particularly. It is the cortex which is exercising this influence upon the whole of us. But the cortex must exercise that its influence not by compulsion, by repression. Here comes the great difficulty. Because whatsoever is realized or achieved through compulsion and repression always produces a hidden reaction, a vengeance reaction inside us. This revenge aspect is there, very deep and very, very subtle. It is, I can assure you, I know from experience how difficult it is to catch the devil there. But it is there. And it rises up when there is the right stimulus. As you know, I am a Parsi. And most of the Parsis of the world live in Bombay. And in Bombay, there used to be Parsi-Muslim riots against each other. So Parsis have had a tendency to grow up with this feeling, oh, he is Muslim, he's an evil man, he's an evildoer, you see. And historically too, the history of the actions of the Arabs and other Muslim people upon the Zarathustrian Iranians is a terrible tragedy, awful cruelty, and the complete extermination of populations in various towns and villages and so on. It's a ghastly story. So you see, there is this inherited conditioning that these people are such. Now that makes it very difficult when you meet somebody, when one meets somebody who is a Muslim, you see, and if there is anything which makes one feel, oh, I don't like him, then that dislike will be not just a dislike which you can more or less neglect, you see, that it doesn't mean anything, but it is a real positive dislike. And this inherited thing comes up when one reads the history of the past. So it is this kind of thing which makes all the difficulty for us members of the human species to live in such a manner that we flower out into our true, fulfilled humanity. That means become perfected holy ones, nothing less than that. You see, people will say, oh, this is being absurdly idealistic and so forth. Well, what sort of a world have the not absurdly idealistic people produced during the last 3 or 4 million years? Have they done any better? The absurdly idealistic people are the people. There are few, perhaps a few thousands at most. A few thousands at most during the millions of years that we have been on the globe who did become the perfected holy ones. And what their influence is the one which has taught the human race the meaning of religious living. To put it in short, straightforward, simple terms, religious living means living the whole of the secular life in thought and feeling, speech and action, in complete harmony with the supreme spiritual values: love, wisdom, goodness, purity, beauty, and so on. Living in that way. So now, when we study religion, as we call it, what we are doing is, we are reading a language. And the words of that language are interpreted by us in our own particular way, somewhat correctly, often largely incorrectly, you see, and we churn up a whole, the whole of the thinking process, as we call it, which is only silent chatter. We churn that up, and that chatter goes on continuously in the brain, it never stops. Even when we don't have dreams, as we say, it goes on. It doesn't calm down. And it is all associated with the imperfect human condition in which we are. The subhuman condition, as I call it. I never say subhuman in a pejorative sense. It is a simple, straightforward fact. You see, we aren't fully human yet. And as I have said several times in past meetings, the word human means the happy, or if you like, the blissful creator. See, the root man, the Sanskrit root man, in the dictionary you will find it given as to think. But Since all our ordinary thinking is just silent chatter, it is not the real meaning of that root man. This root man really means creative thinking. In Genesis, for instance, you find it put this way, "And God said, let there be," etc. I don't like that translation. I would rather put it this way, "And God minded." The activity of mind in its supreme sense is a creative activity, not just an imitative or a procreative activity in the ordinary sense. Procreation means making things true to type. But this is making things absolutely new every time. Have you ever tried to imagine? Do try it as an experiment. Spend a few minutes on various occasions. Try and imagine this extraordinary creative energy which creates out of nothing. There is no type to copy. Mind is that kind of power. But it is that kind of... Then you'll say to me, because I constantly talk of this primordial creative energy, then do you identify it with primordial creative energy? Not quite. It is... You see, the primordial creative energy manifests, is capable of manifestation in innumerable ways. In innumerable ways. Now, this way, which we term mind, is this archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy which acts formatively, produces form. Right? Form implies manifestation. And form has two aspects. One which is the invisible aspect, just as the great philosophers have talked of, the informing power, the informing sense in this, that or the other, that is non-physical, non-material. And the other aspect of this formative thing is that it gives it a shape. And it is a material shape. You see? So, living religiously means living in such a manner that the person becomes the perfected Holy One, which implies that mind can function freely through him. Now, it is almost impossible to find an example in history, even amongst the founders of the great religions, perfected holy ones though they were, of them being able to create by mind power, you see, in the sense that the ultimate reality, God or transcendence, whichever word you like, created the cosmos. It is very difficult to find that. But they do exercise creative power insofar as their presence in the world, their example of the holy life in the world, and their teaching, which was given to those who were really earnest, genuine seekers after truth. You see? That has changed the psyche of the whole world. We individuals don't know of these sort of psychical influences at play. This is where the word magic has a certain significance. But I won't go into that now. Let us be concerned with our particular job, so to say. we have been spending the whole of the last autumn, since the beginning of the autumn last year, we have been trying to cleanse the mind. Well, not the mind, because we haven't got a mind, we've got a psyche. To cleanse the psyche of its conditioning. And when one tries to cleanse the psyche of its conditioning, one undergoes a drastic, traumatic experience. It's an experience which is not just an experience. It is a continuous experience. We have to release ourselves from, release the psyche from all that clogs it up. We have talked, if you remember, of teachings about heaven and hell, of survival after death and judgment. We have talked of various things like that, haven't we? Consider how this idea of survival ever came into being. It's an extremely ancient belief. When I say extremely ancient, I don't mean in thousands of years, but in thousand times a thousand years. Consider, one of the ways, I suggest it only as one of the ways, in which the idea may have come up. In the very early, in the dawn of the human race, once tribes began to form, families getting together, cooperating together and so on, produced a tribe, and tribes were at war with each other. And the big strong man killed his enemy. Several big strong men killed their enemies. Then they had dreams in which they saw the enemy who was killed. And you and I know from our own experience with dreams, I know very well, sometimes when I have dreamt of a lion, you see, the extraordinary inability to do anything to the lion, and even more, even to run away from him. Your legs won't run, your arms won't display strength, and so on. So those people must also have felt the same thing. The big strong chief, when he woke up next morning, he must have woken up in a sweat of fear and terror. Why couldn't I do anything against him? But I'm sure I killed him. How did I see him? Because he couldn't understand at all. That big strong man couldn't understand at all that when the necessary stimuli affect some of the brain cells, the locked up memory comes up of that man. And he sees the man as he sees in his dream. It's as simple as that. But we have learned that in the 20th century AD. They didn't know anything like that. They hadn't the ability or the brains to think like that at all. All that they knew was that, yes, I saw the man I killed. And then his friends, the other fellows also saw and had dreams like that. And they all agreed that there must be something which goes on after the death of the body. So that was the spirit. The spirit goes on. It lives. And it lives. It is of such a nature that I can't hurt it at all. But it frightens me. So, what shall I do? I better make friends with it. And living people knew from their experience that you give gifts and do things like that in order to make friends with members of a tribe who may be stronger than you. You see? And so forth. So, the whole system of placatory rites with the senseless slaughter of innocent animals and sometimes of human beings all came into being. I'm sure that is one of the ways in which this thing happened. Now, they started talking, and the people said, look, you are the big chief of our tribe, and they associated spirits with all the phenomena of nature too, against which they could not prevail. The phenomena were stronger than them. They also must have spirits somewhere. And just as we have you as a chief, these spirits must have a chief. Notice how right throughout our lives, we who are educated and civilized and clever people and so forth, we think ourselves analogically into the realms where we don't function freely. So analogically, they made out gods and godlings and pleasant spirits and evil spirits and all that kind of thing, you know. And perhaps there must be a very, very big chief who is overlord over the whole lot. So their idea of God came into being. There is no such thing as God in that sense. There is transcendence, there is God, the unknown, and by us, because we are so conditioned, the unknowable. Because if there were not, all this could not be. So God is a reality, an absolute reality, transcendence. Use any word you like. Brahman, the Hindus did the best. I think the Brahmanical teachers of the Upanishads, they got perhaps the deepest idea so far, the deepest mode of expression. This personal God idea, as a personal, identifiable, separate being, possess all the qualities, the good qualities which I have in apotheosis, and that is a wonderful error. Because if God is, they say on the one hand, God is everything, the infinite and the eternal and so forth, all right, then where did evil come from except from God? And as a matter of fact, Zarathustrianism originally did teach that. That out of the being of Ahura Mazda came the evil spirit and the good spirit. And if you look at in Deuteronomy chapter 30 verse 15, the Lord God says unto Moses, I have placed before you good and evil, life and death. I have done it, God. So you see, for millions of years we have been conditioned in a terrible way. Now, up to a point, there is no harm in that conditioning, because that conditioning is all done out of a goodwill for our best interests to develop and flower out into true humanity. You see, but they have never known the meaning of the word humanity. So now, insofar as the conventional beliefs and ideas are an influence for persuading, not compelling, but persuading man to lead a better life, to strive after the great values, the ethical values. That's what it comes to. Religious living is ethical living, and that is the whole of it, actually. You see? If it persuades them that way, then they have a place. Then again, the fact remains that thousands, millions of human beings just haven't the ability, the intellectual ability to see that all this is backward stuff. The doctrines of heaven and hell are essentially doctrines of punishment and revenge and reward and sort of, you're a good chap, come up and stay with me up in the heavens, you see. You know, if mankind went into heaven as the only possible place he could go to, he'd get thoroughly bored with the blessed place. In Zarathustrianism, for instance, it is they taught that that in heaven they are so happy they are constantly reciting the Avesta, the prayers. My godfathers. The Christians have wonderful harps and orchestras on the small scale. I don't know whether they have modern orchestras on the large scale there, but there you are. When Annie Besant wrote a book called A Study in Consciousness, and she talked of the great composers, her language was marvelous. It was so wonderful. No wonder one fell for it. She says, and here Beethoven, no longer deaf, pours out his imperial soul in strains of unexampled beauty. You know, this is all stuff and nonsense. Absolute stuff and nonsense. We have to, if we stick to the idea of a personal God as an identifiable separate entity, then we are only projecting ourselves into God, which is quite the wrong way around, isn't it? And Elohim created man in his own living likeness. Not Elohim made man in his image. An image is a dead thing. The totality of the universe is alive, eternally alive. Even matter is eternal. You take any bit of matter and try and annihilate it. You can't. If you set fire to this, it will, of course, go up in smoke and cinders and ash and so forth. Weigh all the products, they'll be exactly the same weight as this thing. You have not annihilated matter. You can't annihilate matter. And if you ask me why, I would say for this reason. The primordial creative energy became everything. And as it became everything, the whole of that primordial creative energy and its context, the whole context of its infinity, its eternity, is embodied in every single particular which it created. Now, you know, you've never heard this before except from me. You won't find it written anywhere at all. I may be wrong. We have to bear that in mind. But I feel that is the truth of the matter. You all know the word hologram, what a hologram is. You see, the universe is holographically created. Every bit of the universe, as we see it through our senses and so forth, is a microcosm representing the macrocosm. See, people don't think about these things. That is to say, really try and see with pure insight. Insight has to be pure. But insight can never be pure as long as we cling to all these absurd teachings in all the religions of the world. Even Buddhism, for instance, although the Buddha said things like this, because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded. If there were not, there'd be no release from this which is born, become, made, compounded, etc. You see? Now what does he really mean by that statement? Can I in my lifetime as an ordinary mortal be released in some extraordinary way into the unborn, unbecome, unmade and so forth? Not at all. This which I experience as the as I myself, the personal self, you see, will just perish, completely perish at death. Nothing whatsoever remains. There is no such thing as the continuity of permanent continuity of an identifiable separate entity. You see, that starting point, use the word God if you like, it has the very great advantage of being an impressive monosyllable. That is its great advantage, you see. That starting point, when creation took place, expanded into the totality. It did not remain separate. We as we are, limitedly conscious, cannot avoid being conscious in terms of separateness. We as we are, with our limited consciousness, cannot avoid being conscious in terms of separateness. So, what is the process? What is taking place? What is our real evolution? Consciousness functioning in this organism, this member of the human species, liberates itself from all that confines it. You see? And it becomes conscious, ultimately, in terms of infinity and eternity, which is in God consciousness, in the absolute consciousness. The Buddha never explained this sort of thing, but you know the Upanishadic teachers did give hints about this. They did give hints, but it needs profound meditation, real meditation, not just having these rituals, these talking rituals in the mind. In the brain, which pass off as meditation. When the brain does absolutely stop talking, and it is possible because it has been done, when it absolutely stops talking, how are you conscious? In what manner are you conscious? You are conscious in the manner of infinity and eternity, of the totality, which is transcendence, which is the absolute all. That is why the Upanishadic teachers, without hesitation, said, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. It would have been better if they had said, they put it the other way around, Brahman is me. Because you see, the Upanishadic teachers included, anyone and every one of the great spiritual teachers the world has known, every one of them functioned both ways. You see, that is to say, in the transcendent mode of totality as well as in the limited mode of separate personal individuality. Because if they lost their ability to function in the mode of separate personal individuality, they couldn't have maintained their life in the world of things, in the world of material things. They couldn't have done it. This is the sort of thing which I shall bring out in the next book. I'll have to. It will be a new ontology. So, for us here, who have met for so many years together, some not so many years, but our oldest member of the groups, Frank. It is important that we let go, not cling to these ideas, because they are all limiting ideas. And as long as they are there, the psyche is like a collection of solid obstacles. And the light of transcendence cannot penetrate that. Although transcendence itself is totally embodied in the obstacles, but transcendence is free. Transcendence is completely embodied in every one of us here. And transcendence embodied in each of us is totally free. But our consciousness is limited. We don't know that God is here, right here. So if with our meetings we can help to bring about some sort of liberation from all these teachings and ideas and techniques and so forth. Look at the way the meditation techniques, as they are called, have been abused in America particularly. And strangely enough, it is just two or three people in America who are responding to the sort of thing I'm saying. They are keen that it should be done, produced and written. Otherwise I won't have written even this book. So what the Zarathustrians how they'll respond is a very big question mark. They'll say this awful agent of Satan who is destroying all our wonderful teachings and great teachings. It's a pity. Our heaven and hell is here in the material world. It's rather interesting that one of Zarathustra's teachings, 1500 plus 900, 2400 years after his death, got developed into this kind of idea, that in the ultimate, all the forces of good will triumph in battle against the forces of evil. There'll be a complete renovation of the world. It'll be like paradise. And all souls will recover their old bodies, live in families as they did before without begetting children, although they'll have familiar relationships, and they will live immortally like that, not needing food. Well, you know.
And the cat.
I mean, how people can be so utterly stupid as to propound such ideas is simply incredible. Wait a minute, I made a mistake. Not 2,400 years. It was before the Sasanian Empire broke up. That's 500 plus 1,500, about 2,000 years. You know, I frequently make mistakes like this nowadays.